You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome back to another episode of The Spear. Charlie Faint, your host. Today's guest is J.J. Pinter. J.J. is a West Point graduate and combat veteran who served in the Army as a field artillery officer. After his military service, he held both leadership and analytical positions in the construction, defense, and medical industries. J.J. is currently the deputy director for Team Red, White, and Blue, America's health and wellness community for veterans. J.J., welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Charlie. Glad to be here.
JJ, we've known each other for quite a while, but this is the first time we've kind of been face to face. I know you're a West Point graduate. Can you talk to us a little bit about what drove your decision to go to the academy and why you decided to join the Army?
Yeah, it was a lot of factors. I think first and foremost, my dad is an Army veteran, and my uncle, who played a big part in my life, was a Vietnam vet, and both they were NCOs, and I grew up on a farm, like a true working farm in Michigan, and I always knew I wanted to join the military, and I didn't really know much about it, and I just was thinking about enlisting, and my mom, who is an educator, just kind of said, hey, if you don't go to college right now, you probably are not going to go. You're going to go start a family. And so she wasn't like anti-enlisting in any way. She just said, you know, I really want you to go to college right now. And I told the recruiter, and the recruiter said, well, the Army has a college. And I was like, really? I didn't really know what West Point was. And he dropped off a brochure at my house. And that was how the whole thing started. And it was just kind of this, you know, way for me to do two things that I wanted to do and make everybody happy. It was kind of just a happy mistake, I guess.
That's pretty interesting. I never heard of anyone refer to West Point as that, but it's 100% accurate. Yes, the Army has a college, and it is West Point. So when you got to West Point, did you visit prior to, or just show up on reception day?
No, I visited once, and I will say, I was a farm kid. Like, I think I left the state of Michigan like one time in my life before I went to West Point. So I was not well-traveled. I was not well-cultured. My dad did take me to West Point one time in the dead of winter. I graduated with 38 kids from public high school. So it was just like this big kind of cool-looking thing at the time. So I didn't really know. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know anyone that graduated from there. I didn't know anything about it, really, other than I'd heard the name, obviously.
As you know, but our listeners probably don't, I didn't go to West Point. I did ROTC at Georgia Military College and Mercer University, but I'm very familiar with the process, having worked here for 10 years now. Did you have any sense of buyer's regret when you got here on reception day and your indoc started happening?
Yeah, I think everybody does, right? I was just like, I think it was less then, and it was more kind of later on when I started talking to my friends that were doing other things, and I was like, oh man, that sounds like a lot of fun. You're like going to parties and drinking beer. I think that, you know, I think maybe a little bit later on. I've always had this kind of competitive streak. And so I think initially it was just kind of like, okay, I think there was the athlete in me was like, okay, like I can do this. Like, I don't know if this is going to play out, but like, if I end up leaving this place, it will be on my own terms at some point in the future. It was kind of, I think, my mindset.
So what kind of things did you spend your time doing here other than the normal stuff? What was kind of your outlet or your point of emphasis when you were a cadet?
Oh, the first few years, it was desperately trying to not fail out. Yeah, I mean, I graduated 38 kids. I mean, I was just trying to not fail out. I mean, I graduated 38 kids, no AP classes. Academically, I was not ready. And I almost failed out. I struggled academically really the first 2 years until I kind of got caught up a little bit. And I ended up behind the dean's list when I was a first year. So I was really proud of that turnaround, but it was a long, hard path to get there. I failed people don't know what the WPWE is anymore. I failed it 3 times. I almost couldn't get past like EN 302, like all these things. So yeah, that. And then once I got to be a little bit later on in my academic career, I was on the skeet and trap team, which I like to shoot, grew up hunting, and that was an awesome club opportunity. You get to travel all around the country shooting, which is really fun, and I've always liked to work out, so I spent a lot of time, you know, lifting weights and running and that kind of stuff.
So what was your major when you're here? What did you study?
Civil. Yeah.
Right on.
And again, my dad was a contractor and a farmer, and I was like, civil engineering sounds kind of like carpentry. I didn't know. And so I just kind of landed in it, and I had some upperclassmen that were civil majors, and they kind of like pushed me in that direction. And that's how I landed. Yeah.
So when you got commissioned, you became a field artillery officer. What attracted you to that branch?
Yeah. I don't feel like a field artillery officer, and we'll go into that in a little bit, but yeah, I knew I wanted to be a combat arms officer. Looking back at it, and I can go into this story, the infantry branch just like did the worst PR on the planet back then. You know, you'd go to Buckner and do infantry week, and they just try to make it as miserable as possible. And I got done with Camp Buckner, and I was like, screw this. I'm not doing that. Like, why would you go branch infantry? This is just miserable. Later on, after I spent time in infantry battalions, I turned out that I really liked it. And I wish I would have been there, but I knew I wanted to be combat arms, and back then, you know, it was kind of a mathematical thing. At the time, it was a math problem. I knew I didn't want to be infantry, and my best opportunity for getting a good post would be in the field artillery branch, and that was kind of how I landed there. It wasn't like my love for artillery or anything like that. A lot of my friends were branching in.
You alluded to not feeling like a field artillery officer, and yeah, I'm very interested to unpack that story. So after graduating from West Point, you went to the officer basic course for field artillery. And if I remember correctly, that's when 9/11 happened. What was that like for you being a young lieutenant at OBC when that terrorist attack occurred?
I was a very fresh lieutenant. There was 2 OBC classes and I was in kind of the second one, which started in August. And I had been at OBC like just a couple weeks. And yeah, it was a lot of things. It was uncertain. It was scary. You know, we just didn't really know. We were just kind of like locked down on Fort Sill at the time. Nobody really knew what was going on. I think there was this sense of, okay, this is about to get real. I definitely probably took it way more seriously than I might have otherwise. And I think my classmates did as well. And there was a lot of guessing and positioning and posturing because people wanted to like kind of be part of what we knew was coming in terms of like military action. And so we knew what posts we were going to, but we didn't know at the time what units we were going to. So everyone was trying to like kind of position themselves to get to where they thought they could deploy.
I remember that 9/11 happened when I was a company commander in Korea. And not only was I stuck in air quotes in the 2nd Infantry Division in Korea, I also knew that I had to go to the advanced course after I came out of command. So I just knew that the wars would be over long before I had my chance to get in it. So I understand that maneuvering and posturing, and it seems silly looking back now, 25 plus years later, that, I mean, the wars went on for 20 years afterwards, but I can definitely empathize with that. So where did you end up maneuvering yourself into when you got your first duty station?
So I picked Fort Hood, and it was not really, again, because I had this love of Fort Hood. It was a lot of my friends were going there. Again, like, you don't know what you don't know. I wanted to be like in a heavy unit at the time, and it was kind of just like the best choice for me for then. And I wanted to go to the 1st Cav and like send some letters and end up going to the 1st Cav because we thought that at the time our uninformed, we thought that they would be the first one out the door. It turned out to be wrong. You know, there's people at the time, there was 2 divisions there. There was a 3rd ID in the 1st Cav, and the 3rd ID ended up doing the initial invasion. So I missed that, but turns out I ended up getting my fill. So I didn't need to worry about that too much.
So before your first deployment, were there many troops in your company, battery, platoon, whatever you were at that level that had combat experience up to that point?
Yeah. No, there was a couple old crusty NCOs that had like Gulf War patches, Very, no. You like, there are a lot of slick right shoulders. You did not see many at all. No.
What year did you deploy for the first time?
March of 2004.
Okay. And where did you go?
So initially I was like over on Advon, and cause at the time we were taking all our equipment. So we had to do the whole railhead thing and put the equipment on the boats and all that stuff. And so I got stuck with on Advon. So I was there early. So went to Camp Arif John and Camp Wolverine and Camp Arif John in Kuwait, and then Baghdad, and then Camp Taji, which is one of the things I want to talk about later. I had like a really kind of fun and atypical deployment. But in the green zone, which turned into the international zone for part of it, and then up north at Camp Taji for part of it, which was a really cool experience.
So you mentioned on some other podcast that your unit was tasked with route clearance. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we did. So this is why I say I don't really feel like a field artillery officer, because my first job was I was a company FSO. So I was immediately in an infantry battalion. And I found out that I really liked it there. I was in 2-7 Cav, which is consequently where I met the founder of Team RWV, Mike Irwin. We were both second lieutenants there together. And then I came back and to deploy to my home battalion. They kind of pulled us all back, and we basically retask organized as a maneuver battalion was essentially what we did, because we were doing some route clearance and then mostly like convoy security. And escort, like low-level VIP escorts. So we immediately task organized into that. And for my entire deployment, other than the time in Taji, which we'll talk about in a second, we were just kind of like a half-ass infantry unit, really, because we just had, that's what we were doing. And then I came back and kind of went back to as a battalion level fire supporter. So I didn't really ever do any artillery. And so I find that when you talk to artillery people, they love to talk about artillery. And I'm like, I never really did any, you know, I was either in infantry units or doing kind of an infantry mission in a field artillery unit.
What was the perception of that change of mission like for you and your troops?
I think everyone was just excited to like be in the fight. Initially, we didn't have the equipment for it, you know, so we were trying to make do with what we had. We brought a couple paladins, but we didn't bring everything, and they just like sat in the corner. And so we had to draw some equipment, but we brought all of our stuff from Fort Hood. So we're in this like old school non-armored soft top Humvees for at least the beginning of it. Then we started to get some armored stuff. So I think people were excited. I always think this is so interesting. If when you're in garrison, what you'll kind of let lower level like lieutenants and like E5s and E6s be in charge of, compared to like what you have to let them be in charge of when you're you know, like you won't even let them run a range on their own when you're in garrison, but yet we're taking like second lieutenants and E6s and like sending them on dangerous missions by themselves in Iraq. So I think that is exciting, you know, this idea of like you get actually a chance to do your job.
That is exciting, and I'm smiling as you're talking about this, because I had the same experiences, and it's always been interesting to watch it when you take the reins off, how pleasantly surprised you can often be, almost all the time, by how much they can actually do if you give them some good guidance, good resources, and let them cook, in the parlance of the kids these days. So yeah, I've seen that also, JJ, as well.
I find that as a parent too with kids.
For sure.
If you like, they'll kind of rise to the level of your expectations. And so I find that with kids as well.
Yeah, you got to be willing to assume some risk there as a parent or as a commander. But I like doing that. And I also find that I have more time to do leader tasks if I'm letting everybody else do tasks that somebody else can do, and I concentrate on doing things only that leaders can do. And JJ, you mentioned a minute ago that you really liked being in that infantry unit. What made that attractive to you? What was good about being in that type of environment?
I like being the main effort. At the end of the day, I mean, isn't that what we want to do? I like being part of the main effort. Like there is the engineer in me does like the gunnery piece of artillery, where it's like, it's physics. And like, I do like that. I find it interesting personally because I like math, but yeah, I like being part of the main effort. And so it's just, I like that environment more.
So you mentioned that you had some interesting experiences in Taji. Do you want to move into that?
Yeah, this is what I think was really interesting. So I would say in the late summer of 2004, I was a battery XO at the time, I guess more like a company XO. And my company commander wakes me up and he says, "Hey, we got this really weird mission that just came down from brigade. Basically, there is this, Camp Taji is this camp that's about 20 miles north of Baghdad, and they're taking rocket fire, and there's a National Guard 105 battery there shooting counterfire, and they can't range these rockets. Also, not to go into too much detail, but there were some rockets that were being shot into the Baghdad airport, and they can't kind of range them from there. So they're like, hey, we need some people to go shoot counterfire up at Camp Taji. And he's like, I don't know anything about the mission. Go over there, pick two guns, put together two gun crews and a small FDC. You basically you handpick who you want and just go to Taji. And so he wakes me up and tells me this. And I'm like, okay. So I did. So I kind of handpicked the people I wanted. We went and got two paladins running, drove them up MSR Tampa. And I ended up spending 2 months just linked up with this National Guard battalion that was up there, this Arkansas National Guard battalion. And I was completely by myself at Camp Taji shooting counterfire every day at this firing point, completely by myself. I'm like a first lieutenant, and it was an incredible leadership experience. It was just super fun because I didn't know anything about it. And my boss was like, just go, here's this random major's name, go find them when you get up there. And so that was a really cool experience because I spent 2 months. It was that did make me feel like a field artilleryman because I was up there just shooting counterfire. It was awesome. You know, so we're shooting live rounds in combat every day. I'm by myself. I have no boss. I don't really have any way to communicate with them. So I would go to this brigade headquarters and call down on the DSN or whatever the hell it was called. You know what I mean? To the battalion headquarters, check in once a week. I didn't really have a way to communicate with them. And yeah, it was awesome. It was super cool.
What an amazing opportunity to be able to do your job in combat semi-independently with a handpicked team.
It was awesome. I got to do everything myself, right? It was go pick out a firing point, set up the guns, figure out how you're going to do the FDC, get your AFATADs connected with, these other national, this was my first experience working with National Guard units, with these National Guard units. And then all of a sudden, okay, that's working. It's hey, the Kiowas are going to start lasing targets. Can you shoot that? Hell yeah, we can shoot that. If you get the rounds, we'll shoot it, And that was really cool. And it turns out the way the timeline worked, a bunch of my classmates were there, flying those helicopters. And so I'm working with people I knew from the academy, it was a super cool experience.
So what was integration like? You mentioned that you hadn't worked in the National Guard before. These guys obviously didn't know who you were. What was that relationship like?
I think it's what I've learned, Charlie, is that at the end of the day, everything comes down to leadership all the time. Right. And so I actually spent a few years in the National Guard after I left active duty. So I'm a person, you spend a lot of time talking shit about the National Guard when you're on active duty. But the National Guard, I have a lot of respect for the mission they do because it's hard. And I spent time in the Guard, but there's no way that someone can be as proficient as when they don't do something every day as you can.
Right.
But what they have that we don't have on active duty is you have all these people with these really diverse experiences in their private jobs. So you got plumbers, electricians, and mechanics, and you have all these people, and it makes for a really rich group of people. And so it took me a second to kind of figure out how to navigate that. And a lot of things, I think, what do you want to do? You want to make you don't want to create problems for your boss, right? And you want to add value. And so that was what I tried to do. And I've never been a person, I don't want a lot of guidance. I don't want a lot of oversight. Just tell me what you want me to do. Give me some right and left boundaries. Give me some resources. And I'll let you know if I have any problems. I'm not going to pester you. And that was what I tried to do in that scenario. And it was a lot of begging and borrowing and stealing things that you needed, right? It was hey, we don't have any maintenance support. So I got to go get batteries for the guns from this. I got to go make friends with someone from this forward support company and try to get some, there's a lot of that kind of stuff and not creating problems for the people that I was opcon to. I didn't know what the hell being opcon meant, honestly, at that point. I was a first lieutenant. I hadn't been in the army that long.
It seems like your commander was very comfortable in giving you the what and the why and letting you sort out the how. Do you think that's accurate?
I do, 100%. He gave me good, something I still have used, taken out of the Army career that I use in my current job is like this idea of commander's intent.
Yeah.
And he gave me like really good intent. And it was like, okay, stop them from shooting rockets and hurting people on this FOB. Like, okay, like
Roger,
like I can do that, you know? So I think that was, he gave me good intent, and like ultimately I had enough resources and yeah, we were going to make it happen.
So you had two guns. Is that a section?
Yeah.
You call that. Okay. So you had a gun section. I presume you had some non-commissioned officers there with you to help you out.
Yeah. I had gun chiefs. So I had like two gun sections, and then I had the part that was more complicated was the FDC. Mm. So we had to kind of set up a FDC, and ultimately like I had an NCO that did, we took turns doing 12-hour shifts. So he would do 12 hours and I would do 12 hours, like just working in the FDC because we just didn't have, you know, people. And so I'm trying to like work in the FDC and then also do all the kind of leadership stuff. But like, what else are you going to, like, you know what I mean? Like, what else are you going to do? I mean, we're just kind of there at the firing point all the time.
That's right. And you still have 10 to 12 hours to lift, eat chow, write letters home, play some Xbox, whatever you're gonna do.
Do all the leadership stuff, right?
So, right.
So I was still ultimately was like going to some of the meetings at this, you know, with like the unit I was up. Like I still had that kind of leadership stuff that I had to do. So yeah.
So even with that type of op tempo, what do you think morale was like for you and your troops at a time where you're doing that mission?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, how many field artillery men never shoot a real round? Like we were shooting like rounds in combat every day. People were calling us and saying, hey, I'm in trouble. And the thing that was really interesting there was, you know, you're trying to navigate, it's like, how can you get the rounds where you need them to go, right? Because you're dealing with like, I don't want to go like a bunch of field artillery talk, but you got to make sure you're doing it safely, but you got limited windows of how you can kind of get them there, right? Because this is an urban environment, this is a big city, and you obviously don't want to be like putting rounds where they are not supposed to be.
That's right. And you mentioned that you had Paladin systems, right? Mm-hmm. so self-propelled artillery, so tracked tubes. And yep. is that
105
so big, yeah. Big guns. Yeah, you big definitely guns. Want to put those in the right spot. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you did that for 2 months, and then what happened?
Yeah, then I came back and picked up the regular mission. And it was super high op tempo. It was every day, you know, very busy. I remember we drove, my battalion drove 1,000,000 miles of escorts.
Wow.
You know, practically during the course of that deployment. It was there's a lot of driving. It was super exciting, you know, and then you get to the point where I think shortly after that, like my boss went on his mid-tour leave. And so I got a chance to like, kind of, that was like my first experience of being in command, I guess, because I got to be in charge of the battery for a bit. And then I got promoted at some point in there to captain. And so then I got sucked up to the battalion staff, which was fun as well.
On that same deployment, you were, oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. I was a battle captain, you know.
Explain to our audience what you were doing as a battle captain as part of the staff.
Yeah, I didn't do that very long. Everything we were doing was mostly pre-scheduled. And so we would get kind of a list of like, here's the convoys, it was so funny. We would do the prison run where we would take CIA contractors around all the prisons. Funny, Abu Ghraib was one of the prisons we would on a weekly basis. Yeah. You know, we were escorting like dollars around from the banks, you know, like any kind of stuff like that, and like kind of low-level VIP escorts. So that kind of stuff. So they would all be pre-scheduled. So it wasn't a lot of like react to contact, if you want to use that. It would be like, okay, here's the missions we got. And then who's going to do what battery is going to do what. And then inevitably this truck broke down. This one got shot. This one's blown up. Like that kind of stuff. Reacting to that during the course of the day.
I've heard some leaders describe going from direct leadership positions into staff as kind of a letdown, both emotionally and in just like job satisfaction. Did you experience any of that when you made that transition?
Yeah, yes and no. I would think there's a lot of things that made my experience unique with that timeline. And one of the first ones was, it was this era of stop losses and stop moves. So I was with the same people. Like I was with the same field grades for like 3 years. Like,
wow.
Because everyone was stop loss and stop move. So you have these like deep relationships you develop with people. And so it wasn't, to me, it wasn't like I was going to like this unknown, like I knew every single person in that headquarters very deeply. And then I also felt like I had some opinions. I mean, it's the very classic like tree of monkeys, if you know that analogy. Okay, so imagine you have a tree, like a Christmas tree or something, and there's monkeys in it everywhere, right? The ones at the top are in charge and the one at the bottoms are workers. And so the analogy goes like if the monkeys at the top look down, what do they see? Like a lot of
smiley faces.
What do the monkeys at the bottom see? And they look up, it's like a bunch of assholes, right? Like, and so I had opinions about how we could, from doing this for 8 months, like at the battery level, that I could help make things better at the battalion level. So I was excited in that regard.
Nice. Okay. All right. So you've moved up to battalion staff. You're still in Iraq. Anything else strike you from an experiential standpoint that you think is worth mentioning during your time on battalion staff?
I mean, the only things that struck me were I was like, and this maybe helped lead to my decision to exit active duty. I was like, wow, these field grades look really miserable. And they seem to be generally pretty jealous of what we're doing. I was like, that doesn't seem to be a whole lot of fun to me. They're just like writing op orders and con ops and getting yelled at by the brigade XO. And that doesn't seem like very much fun. You know, they're just like hanging out at our battery headquarters whenever they can. So certainly there was part of that that I discovered at the time. And then, yeah, I think being on staff too, I also realized we were going through the Force 21 transformation at the time, which I'm sure you remember. And I also had the realization that I was like, the maneuver guys are never going to let a non-maneuver person command these BCTs. And there's no Devardi now. So it's like, I don't really see a path for myself in this branch anymore. I think I came to that conclusion during that time on battalion staff as well.
I totally understand that. And I think most company grade officers listening to what you just said about your perception of the field grades will be nodding their head at that point. I certainly was, especially when I was a company commander, looking at the field grades that we had, not only in our battalion, but kind of across the division. I didn't want to do what they were doing. They seemed miserable. And they did not seem like good people for the most part. I don't want to do that job. I don't want to be like them. Maybe I'll go do something else. But you also mentioned stop loss. So I got to stick around the Army a little longer than I expected. And then I started getting into some different units and really found my niche. But yeah, that's tough. And I remember when I finally made major, trying to make sure that I was the type of major that the company grades could look up to and approach versus the ones that I didn't like.
Yeah, I will say this, like the field grades that I worked with were good people. Nice. I don't know, even at the time, I don't really think that I thought they were like super technically or tactically proficient, but I did feel like they were good people who cared about me. You know, I did think that was the case. So like, you know, I wasn't really necessarily going to them asking for like advice in that way, but like I did know that I felt like they were going to look out for my best interests for sure.
Oh, that's good, because I didn't have that. In fact, I tried to quit when I was in 2nd Infantry Division. I wrote my resignation letter and everything. And my immediate supervisor, who was a major I did like, sat on it, which I'm grateful for to this day, because I got stop loss shortly thereafter and wouldn't be able to quit anyway. So no sense in kind of burning everything down with my resignation letter when it wouldn't have worked anyway. So yeah, well, all right, that's great. So you mentioned that you decided to leave the service, and you kind of described why you were doing it. You were going to try something else. What did you end up doing immediately after you got out of the active duty?
Yeah, I think that, Charlie, there's like a little bit more to it. So that deployment turned out to be like 14 months because I was on ADVON, and then because I got stuck on port duty at the
end.
People don't probably remember what that is, but so I was gone like 14 months, and then my battalion, a couple other things happened, got tagged to fight forest fires, and then in Montana, and then just got back from that, and then Hurricane Katrina happened. And so it was almost like 2 years of nonstop stuff. And I was just like pretty burned out on it at the end of it. I'll be perfectly honest. And then, you know, and the things I said before about not seeing like a path in the field artillery branch for myself. And I also met the lady who is now my wife of, you know, over 15 years. And there was just like a lot of things that caused me to want to leave. But what was interesting was, at the time, I had 3 years of inactive ready reserve on the end of my contract, which historically that kind of didn't mean anything, but not in 2006. And my classmates were getting jerked out of the IRR left and right and redeployed because they needed like experienced company grade officers. And so the National Guard saw some opportunity there and they kind of said, oh, hey, you can come to the National Guard and you don't have to worry about being recalled to active duty. And we'll give you some 2 years of stabilization if you come to the National Guard. And they were so short people, they were like, pick basically any job you want. Like, you can, we'll let you go wherever you want. And so I was like, sign me up. So I transitioned into the Texas National Guard. And I actually did my company command there in the National Guard, which was really interesting. So yeah, I did another 3 years in the Texas Guard, which I think was good. And I actually also think it was really good for my transition out of the military because it forced me to kind of stay in shape more so than maybe I would have otherwise, because I wanted to like obviously lead by example from that regard. Yeah. So that was kind of how I ended up working my way out of the Army. But yeah, it was certainly a positive experience, but I was like pretty burned out. And you remember what it was like at the time. Orphergen wasn't a thing back then. Like, no one was looking at my dwell time. It was like, all I could see was a year on, a year off deployments as far as the eye could see. And I was just like, eh, I don't know about that.
You're absolutely right. In addition to that deployment cycle, you still had to do training. You still had to do everything else. You're trying to have a life.
Oh yeah. That's the other thing is it's not like you get a year off. It's like, okay, we're back for a couple. We're going to go on block leave. All right, we're going to NTC. You know, I mean, the time in between, because you got some new battalion commander coming in who wants to make his mark, right?
And it's yes.
Like, we're going to start training. And I was like, oh, I can't do it right now.
Well, and plus in the years that you're describing, Iraq was hot.
It was hot.
Guys were getting blown up.
It was hot
and
it was hot and it was dangerous. It was. Yeah.
And the types of missions that you were doing, to me, it sounds like you're being very modest about what you and your guys were doing. I don't know that there was any more dangerous job than route clearance and escort. To me, the most dangerous places, I served in Iraq 3 times, to be were out on those roads because you can't control the environment. There's all kind of ways to attack, and they got very good, especially when the Iranians started introducing those copper-faced IEDs. That was a dangerous job. And I was at Balad on the FOB there, yeah. And we had the theater graveyard there for the vehicles, and that kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger every time I went back. So that what an incredible mission that for you and your troops.
Yeah, it was exciting. It was dangerous. Like, trucks were getting blown up on the regular. Like, that was part of it. And the IEDs kept getting better and better and better. So it was like this cat and mouse game of like of getting better with avoiding IEDs, and then like VBIDs started to become more of a thing. Yeah, so it was. I could see it changing. Certainly, you know, at the time.
So when you were in Iraq, in these downtimes in between fire missions. Maybe you're in the fire direction center, the FDC there with some of your enlisted troops. Did they ever ask you any questions about why we're here or any kind of high level strategic questions or politics or anything about why we were in Iraq?
Oh no. Everyone, I mean, this was so close to 9/11 that people were like fired up to be there. You know what I mean? It was, I imagine it was very different right now. So I did not spend any time. It was like reining people in more than it was, you know, like explaining the geopolitics of why we were there. Now, the thing that I did spend more time on is we spent lots of time talking about the differences between like Sunni and Shia Muslims and like that kind of stuff, trying to get people smart on the nuances of operating where we were. But yeah, we didn't spend any time talking about like everyone was like wanted to be there for the most part.
Amazing.
It was, I mean, it was just so close to 9/11. That was so
right.
It was so like fresh still that people were just like,
yeah, let's do this for sure. All right. So you did your time in active duty, you did your time in the Guard. So then you were out completely?
Yeah, mostly. So I went to work for Caterpillar, which was actually a great place. It was a fantastic company. And I was in Texas still. And it was a great place to work. Again, it was like made for a pretty smooth transition. A lot of veterans worked there. It's very blue collar. People wear uniforms. It like didn't feel that dissimilar to being in the Army. It was great. Had our first kid. My wife and I are both from the Midwest, and it was like, I'm watching my mom is like babysitting for my sister's kids. And I'm like, man, sure would be nice. I got to pay a babysitter $80 every time I want to go have dinner. So we ended up trying to make the decision to move back or we made the decision to move back to the Midwest, and we're trying to figure out kind of deliberately how to do that. And another kind of serendipitous thing happened to me as I was talking to he was a year older than me, but a friend of mine that went to the academy with me. And he was like, hey, I wasn't tracking any of this. He's like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but like two things are happening at Fort Knox right now. HRC is moving to Kentucky, to Fort Knox. And then we just stood up this 3-star command called a Sessions Command. We're trying to like get our arms around. It's basically going to be everyone coming in the military is going to, Army's kind of be in one place. It's going to be like Cadet Command and Recruiting Command and like medical recruiting and like special, all the things are going to be in one place. He's like, people don't want to move from DC to Kentucky. He's like, you could be an ORSA. I was like, what? He's like, I can get you a job as a great job as an ORSA right now. He's like, why don't you do that? Let the Army move you up here, and then you can kind of figure out what you want to do. I'm like, that's actually a pretty good idea. So I ended up doing that, and it turned out to be a wonderful experience because not only did I didn't even know what an ORSA was, honestly. Like, you know, I was always at like company, like battalion level and below. Got a chance to become an ORSA. I spent about 2 years there working on like accession related problems in probably the worst time to try to get people to join the Army ever. And I got a chance to really learn. I learned a tremendous amount there. I had good leadership there. And that was a really, really interesting, great place for me to work. So, and then plus I was working for the Army, but I wasn't in the Army, you know, but I was surrounded by green suiters mainly. And yeah, so I got a chance to do that, which was a tremendous experience.
How did you spend your time after your military service ended? When you're no longer doing government service, what did you decide to do next?
Yeah, so I did that. And then I had always wanted to do medical sales. A bunch of my friends had done medical sales in various ways. And I had kind of tried to do it, but just like the opportunity never worked quite right. And then a friend of mine, who was my roommate at West Point, and then we were stationed together, and then he went the SF route, and anyways, made a long story short, he called me, he had gotten out and was working for this medical sales company, and called me about this job, and I ended up leaving there and going to work medical sales for about a year and a half. And I'm glad I did that, because I learned that is not something that I wanted to do. I think I always would have wondered, but I got to see the kind of dirty underbelly of medicine, the business of medicine, and I wanted nothing to do with it. But I did that for about a year and a half. And I think at that time, I was starting to get pulled. What I was starting to see is like my people that I served with and people I knew were really struggling with the transition out of the military. And I was starting to see it. And I was really starting to see it with some of my classmates. And I remember thinking, man, these people have everything. They have supportive families. For the most part, they have good jobs. They have all the support structure in the world, yet they're still really struggling. And I'm like, what about my soldiers who don't have a lot of that? They don't have the supportive families. And and I started to get pulled back towards like helping in the, I had honestly like was pretty done with the Army when I left, you know, and I got kind of pulled back in a little bit. And then, you know, a friend of mine started Team Red, White, and Blue. And that's another story. I just was a volunteer initially, and I started the chapter in Louisville and ended up, you know, coming on as the second employee there. So that's what kind of pulled me back in. I never had any desire to work in the veteran space or to do nonprofit work, to be honest.
So I want to talk a little bit more about Team RWB, because the work you're doing is so important, and so many people in the military or ex-military are affiliated and are members of Team RWB. I want to back up to something you said regarding the support networks for the junior enlisted troops.
Yeah.
So many years ago, I had a friend who was Special Forces in the National Guard, yeah, and he got blown up twice in Afghanistan. And the second time was catastrophic, traumatic amputation, et cetera. And I went to go see him in Walter Reed. And the day I went to go see him, he was in the bed. He was talking to a doctor. This guy was 18, the wounded soldier was 18 Delta, so he's a Special Forces medic. And he's having like a peer-to-peer discussion with his doctor about his treatment. And off to his left was another former 18 Delta that was debriding his left hand. So he's getting treatment and he's talking to this guy about it. And this particular soldier had been basically a world-class athlete before he got blown up. He was being well taken care of. He's going back home. He's married. He's going to be fine. You know, his employer is going to take care of him. And now as I was leaving, I had a thought similar to what you described, JJ, which is, what about these Poor guys that got blown up on a convoy. Junior listed 88 Mike, driving a truck, got blown up. He didn't come from much. He doesn't have support network. It's going to take him a lot longer to recover. It's just because he's not in the same type of condition and he's not as mature age-wise. This Special Forces non-commissioned officer was in his 30s. What's that guy's life going to be like when he goes home? And I was worried about it. And that's one of the reasons I think what Team RWB is doing is so important. And I'm going to pause now to ask you to describe what Team RWB is and what it does for the veteran community.
Yeah. So at its root, we're a veteran serving nonprofit and we're a health and wellness organization for veterans. And we're creating America's largest health and wellness community for veterans. So we're really focused on physical and mental health for veterans. And the way that I would describe it maybe to this audience is, you know, people hear about the negative outcomes in the veteran space. It's obviously like on the news. So at one end, you have suicide and homelessness and substance abuse and underemployment and all these things. So those are effects is kind of what we would say. And the cause is very often a failed transition. Something went wrong in the transition. And very often it's health related, physical or mental health. So we are trying to put systems in place so that those things don't happen and by keeping physical and mental health good for veterans. And what we do is incredibly simple. And I think that's what makes it work so well.
So when I think of Team RWB, I think of community through physical activity. Is that a good way to visualize?
That's 100% what it is. I mean, here's the way I would describe this. Most people who are listening to this probably know what CrossFit is, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the modalities that CrossFit is using is not, it's not anything fancy or groundbreaking, but what they were able to do was to package up community in a way that people really liked it, right? So you had a community of people, you know, people met each other and hung out and like, and there was this extensive egalitarianism where people were kind of all in it together and doing, everyone's doing the same thing. And I think the community part is important, and that's what we do, except not only do we connect veterans with other people, but we connect them with supportive members of the community. So it gives you can go to a new place, you can meet people, you can do something healthy like exercise. And I think this is, you know, there's a lot of things that you take out of the military, which I think are really positive, but you also take some negative habits out of the military as well.
Right.
And I think one of the things that, I got a couple of them that I would, but one of the things is, the Army makes PT really unfun, right? I mean, it's like, let's go out in cold weather and roll around in the wet grass every day. And like, that's not very much fun.
No.
And so people, I think, consequently stop doing it when they get out. Whereas it can be fun, right? Especially if you're doing it with other fun people. And so, yeah, we're just trying to do that. And then obviously mental health is a big piece, but I think a lot of mental health can really be improved with exercise and eating.
Yes.
And some of these other things. And so we try to do it that way. And when people need more help than that and clinical help, we can get them there as well. So that's what we do.
Yeah. Obviously doing physical fitness will improve your physical health, but you mentioned something that I think is worth repeating, the mental health benefits of physical exercise.
Oh, 100%. And when we first started, we've always believed this. When we first started, people thought we were crazy and selling snake oil, we'd say this, but now it's been proven. Like, I don't even need to convince people anymore. I mean, you can look at, you know, random controlled double blind studies, like exercise is more effective in treating depression than Prozac. I mean, like, so I don't even think people argue about this anymore. Like, it is. Certainly there are mental health conditions that need clinical care, 100%. But depression, anxiety, things like that can often be treated really well with exercise and sleep and improved diet.
Absolutely right. And you mentioned bad habits in the military. I mean, downrange, we'd get 2 hours of sleep a night.
100%.
Wake up, eat a box of Pop-Tarts, pound 6 Rippets, and you do that and it smoke, becomes a habit.
And smoke a cigarette.
Oh, 100, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're eating, yeah, you're going to have a Rippet and Otis Funkmeyer muffin and like smoke a cigarette. Like it's terrible, you know, but those are some of the habits that you take, not sleeping enough, you know, all those things.
Oh, Spunkmeyer. Yeah. The soldiers today don't know the struggle of the mini Rippets and the Otis Funkmeyer.
Yeah.
Cookies and muffins. So yeah. And if you combine that with a sense of community, so you have some accountability partners, like I don't want my buddy to give me crap about not going to the gym and skipping leg day again, so I'm going to go do that. And oh, by the way, if I want to keep up with them on this run, maybe I stop smoking a pack a day and I put down the six pack. And then And then that leads to so many other things. Now I'm not stressing about being fat. My heart's not going to be exploded, not going to explode. I have my own sense of community. So I think those are some important things that Team RWB does for vets.
Charlie, something like 85% of veterans are overweight or obese.
Yeah.
Like, it's terrible. And that's in and of itself is not good, but it's all the comorbidities that come along with those. It come along with being obese. And it's the sense of community. There's shared accountability. There's support. There's hardness. There's all those things that, like, that's the secret sauce. We consider ourselves to be a military adjacent organization. And so we try to have the good parts of the military and to not have the bad parts. So that's one of the things that we really focus on.
So you mentioned Mike Irwin, the founder of Team RWB, and I have a Mike Irwin story.
Okay.
So I got to West Point in 2013, and I didn't know anything about West Point. As I mentioned, I didn't go to school here. I also didn't know anything about Team RWB. I hadn't heard of you guys at this point.
Yep.
And I had gotten in contact with a former battalion commander of mine who was then an SES at SOCOM. And he's like, hey, when you get to West Point, you got to look up this guy named Mike Irwin. I was like, all right. I was like, okay, boss. I mean, who's Mike Irwin? And I was like, oh, he runs Team RWB. And he said this like I should know, right? Like you know Team RWB. And of course, I didn't want to tell him. I didn't have anything. I have no idea what you're talking about. So I was like, Roger, boss, Team RWB, I'll get on it. And that's how I found out about Team RWB. And that's how I met Mike Irwin.
Yeah. Team RWB was started by West Point grads primarily. And it was run by, and it still has a lot of West Point grads that run there. But many of, in the early days, when it was still a young organization, when it was all volunteer run, many of the people were kind of stationed at West Point at the time. We used to have our board meetings in the library at West Point when several of our board members were stationed here. And so, yeah, a lot of connections to West Point, support from people running it. And then honestly, tremendous support from grads that are in kind of positions of influence in the business community. I don't think I appreciated the depth and breadth of the network until Team RWB, because we've seen a lot of support outside as well.
So there's one more Team RWB thing that I want to talk to you about before we move on into some closing thoughts and your advice for young leaders. So one of the things that you all do that I recently found out about was the GWAT 100. And as a multi-tour GWAT vet, as part of a war that seemed to go on for 100 years, can you tell us a little bit about what the GWAT 100 is?
Yeah, it's a super cool event. So this actually ties back to my Taji story. So in Camp Taji, 15 years ago, there was a group of people who decided that they wanted to burn off some steam and to do a little bit of a challenge. So in February, there was a group of people that decided, and you could kind of run around the wire at Camp Taji, that they were going to try to run 100 miles in the month of February. They did it. Some units did it. They had a good experience. And some of the people who were stationed there went back to where they were from in California and said, this is super cool. Let's keep this going and maybe raise a little bit of money for some veterans organizations. And they called it the Taji 100. And they operated that. That became its own organization. And they ran it for 15 years and raised a lot of money for veterans organizations. And we were one of the organizations they raised money for. And our members loved it. It was a cool event. And after the last year, they kind of came to us and said, hey, we feel like this thing has kind of run its course. Would you be interested in kind of taking it over? So we worked with, kind of assumed the event, but they wanted the Taji 100 name to be retired with the event. So we assumed the event and we spent a lot of time thinking about it, and we've stood it back up as the GWAT 100. So it's a 100-mile challenge in the month of February. But what's cool about it is what we're doing is we're focusing on storytelling in a specific geographic area from the global war on terror every year. So the first 3 years of this thing, we're focusing on Iraq and Operation Iraqi Freedom. So we've broken up Iraq into three chunks. There's the kind of the Sunni Triangle region, which is the greater Baghdad area in the center, southern Iraq and northern Iraq. And we're deep diving, we're telling stories of the people and the places and the battles and the FOBs and the routes and like what happened in the Sunni Triangle region in that period of time. And if you do the 100 miles, then the medal is basically a jigsaw puzzle piece of the center part of Iraq. And
if you do all 3 years, you get all three and they fit together like form like Voltron to you get this kind of cool display worthy thing of Iraq. Then we're going to move on and we'll tell stories about southern Iraq and northern, and we'll talk about the drive up from Kuwait and what's that, you know, what that's like, and CSC Scania and all those things. And then we'll go to northern Iraq. We'll talk about Kurdistan and the airborne operations and all that stuff. Then after 3 years, we're going to go to Afghanistan and we'll hit RC North and then East and South and West, and we'll deep dive and tell stories around those. And we didn't really know how it was going to resonate with people, and people have loved it. I mean, and I think it's because we're moving around, we're telling stories, and we're trying to have it not be too heavy and
right.
fun. So if you go look at our social media, we're doing like, what kind of movies were you watching? What kind of movie? We have a Spotify playlist of the music we were listening to. Like, food. I mean, it's just like, it's a lot of fun. You get to hear people talking about how they were, these big tough guys were watching One Tree Hill on the Gilmore Girls and stuff, because like, that's what we would get in box care packages, you know? And I think that that's really cool. But what's been interesting that was unexpected to us is we have military units signing up to do this like crazy, which has been super fun. And I think there's something about it where military units kind of, what's the old George Washington quote? It's like, veterans of future generations, their willingness to serve is going to be proportional to how they perceive veterans of previous generations are treated. I'm butchering it, but that's basically it. And I really think that people in the military are looking and saying, hey, there's someone who's going out of their way to like tell the stories and pay homage to, you know, something that was not that long ago. You know, I mean, it might feel like a long time ago, was not that long ago. That's part of it. The second part of it is we have tons of Air Force units signing up to do this, because the Air Force has to do a 2-mile PT test for the first time ever starting this year. And so it's a great way to help get airmen ready for this kind of new standard, you know? And so we have Air Force units signing up. Like, anything that comes from the command is going to be inherently uncool. Like, that's the way
totally.
It always,
yep.
The way it is now, it's always been that way, right? And so this is kind of a way for military units to kind of not have to like be the person who like dictates it.
Well, if any of them have interesting stories, and it sounds like they do, send them our way for the spear. JJ, I know we're running long on time here, but I wanted to make sure we gave you the opportunity for any closing thoughts you might have, and especially leadership advice that you have based on your experiences for young leaders.
Yeah. For young leaders, I mean, I would just say the thing that I've learned, I think this works as a young leader and an old leader, is that like everything really comes down to leadership and relationships. And like, if you find people who are like the technical skills, people will figure that stuff out. But at the end of the day, like, you got to be able to lead people. And I think today in this environment that's increasingly digital, the ability to like put your arm around someone and lead people is really important. So I just think like focusing on that is really important. And like just the stuff that you already know, like be an asset, like be technically proficient, you know, and like don't cause problems for your boss. You know, if you just kind of do those things, the Army is always, there's a challenge because there's this what I've learned is there's like this juxtaposition between wanting to compete and outcompete your peers, but also being a good teammate at the same time. And learning how to navigate that, I think, is always really important, because at the end of the day, like, it is a competition, and like, you do want to do better, and you want to get the best jobs, and you want to be the best lieutenant in the battalion or the best captain in the brigade or whatever, but you can't do that at other people's expense. You have to do that in a way where you lift everyone up and be a good teammate. You know, I think that's one of the challenges. So don't be a jerk. Like people know how to do this. Like, don't be a jerk. Like, be better at PT than everyone else. Like, just do the small things.
Don't be a jerk is some of the fundamental advice that I give the West Point cadets here. You can go so far in your career and your life simply by not being a jerk. Just be good at the basics. Don't be a jerk, and things tend to fall into place.
I honestly think, Charlie, and I'll say this on the closing, like, I came from a very blue collar environment. I was the first male to go to college in my family, like, you know, small town farming, like redneck stuff. And I always, I think, related more with my soldiers who then like people who came from kind of upper crust, you know, some of my peers who came from like very like wealthier privileged families. And I think I always really enjoyed kind of spending times like with
with my soldiers because I felt like I had more in common with them. And for whatever reason, I think that was one of the things that, you know, helped to allow me to have whatever success I had when I was doing it.
JJ, thank you so much for your time today. I look forward to talking to you again.
Awesome, Charlie. Thank you. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.